today on Movie Wall as we talk about Mission Impossible Fallout, Christopher Robin, and Black Klansman. It's time for Movie Rollers. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And ESG as well.
Movie Rollers is a weekly dose of film reviews, movie news and general banter in theatres, on DVD, online streaming or in the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, this show is for you. Greetings.
He's doing hand gestures because we're on camera today.
Yes.
So he looks like one of those air stewards.
Yes. The exit might be behind you. Please remember. Or they might be there two exits.
I was kind of reading.
I'm so happy Yazdi isn't.
I was kind of reading.
Air steward. I would hate to be on that plane.
Cheesy salesman with the.
There's nothing wrong with the finger gun. Finger gun used judiciously is very effective.
I prefer to just use mine to pick my nose.
Oh, that too.
Lovely. So this is kind of a special episode because...
Why is it special, Joe?
Well, it's kind of arbitrary right in our podcast numbering system, but this does so happen to be episode 400 of Movie Wallers. Thank you for distorting my... You've messed up all my settings. Now, it's amazing. We first started doing this in 2010, believe it or not.
It doesn't feel like that long.
It doesn't.
I don't know that anyone has listened to all 400 episodes.
Ourselves included. Congratulations.
God bless you if you have. But it's kind of amazing to think back.
Although we have to give a shout out to Michelle, who listened to 4 hours of Movie Wallers in a row.
So, yeah, Michelle's a co-worker of, in fact, all of ours at one point. But, we met her on Wednesday, I think, last week. And so, I didn't even hear what she said. 4 hours of Movie Wallers?
4 hours of Movie Wallers on a long drive.
I don't do that.
Oh, and I think maybe we put her to sleep.
I hope not.
I hope we're not putting her to sleep right now because I know she's an avid listener. So, hi, Michelle.
Thank you, Michelle. And thank you to everyone, really, who's been supporting us over the last, 8 years or so.
8 years.
Somebody out there is listening. I know it because the podcasts do get downloaded. And we did. We started over a weekend.
Yeah.
After, I think...
2 years of talking about it.
2 years of talking about it, yeah. Saying we should do a podcast.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, let's do a podcast. Yeah, maybe we should do a podcast. And I think it was mostly Yazdi's fault.
It was Yazdi's fault.
No!
It's totally Yazdi's fault.
You?
Because every time we got together with you, Yazdi, we would talk about movies.
Yes.
Well, that's just...
It's how what we love. Yeah. No,
And we would feel educated by it and enlightened. Yes. So it was always kind of a fun thing to do.
And entertained.
And here we are, 8 years later, 400 episodes, multiple film festivals. I dread to think how many movies that is. It's probably 1,000 movies at this point, right?
Yeah,
easily.
We
watch, more than 100.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's
plus video and, that's just on
streaming. Yeah.
That's a lot of talking. And it pretty much guarantees that none of us can ever run for office because there's so many of our opinions out in the world.
Yeah.
Should I ever run for office? I've got plenty of sound bites that somebody could string into something unpleasant.
I know. I was listening to one of our previous episodes and I thought... I was kind of unkind. Wouldn't want that showing. I wouldn't want that showing up on on my political campaign, like the day before the election.
Like I'm only unkind only on this show.
Yes,
she was like, "Am I barking orders now?"
So I am also going to attempt to put this episode out on video, and one of the things that we have in front of us today is a number of cameras. So
lot of cameras, Joe.
Well, look,
I didn't know he had that many cameras in the house. It's quite unnerving.
It's kind of I've collected them over time.
Yeah,
like with various kind
Group
of
order.
GoPro and
order.
I think we did do a video event a few years ago, the GMCLA Awards. So we had a couple
available
of cameras
on YouTube
that we got for that. That was kind of fun.
Super fun.
Don't do that very often because it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
But that was a very fun.
That was a fun event.
To do. So yeah,
we got to wear our sunglasses on the red carpet.
Yes, and some good pictures. Yeah.
Yeah, he looks like a kind of a badass
kind
bouncer.
Dude,
in that
yeah.
One. And you glammed up too.
I did glam up. Yeah,
you had, we should make that our.
I actually had my head on. Yeah,
yes. I was doing my best to stay behind the camera.
Yeah, fun event.
It was a fun event. So yeah. Well, here's to 400 more episodes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That should be. As long as people keep downloading and listening.
Well, I hope people have as much fun listening as we have doing it, because it's super fun doing it.
It's mostly fun doing it.
Yeah. And I think. No, and I think so, if
that's a lot coming from you, Joe.
No, it's a lot of fun doing this.
No, and I think if people think that there's something we're doing which prevents them from listening to us all the time, they should let us know.
But they're not listening, so they don't know that we're asking them the question, Yazdi.
If a tree falls in the forest.
If you made it this far, please send us an email. Let us know. Like, you know, are we talking too much about a movie that nobody's seen yet that doesn't make sense?
Yeah.
Or, you know, should
or is it just fun to listen to us bantering?
Yeah, well, I mean, I hope the format works. I mean, I listen to a bunch of different movie review podcasts. Some are very short, some are like in depth. They go on for hours. You know, we try not to do that because, I tend to tune out of things that go on for, you know, half an hour is enough to discuss a movie in detail.
I think so.
Yeah,
but,
I do too.
Okay, so let's wave at the camera. The main one.
Which one?
I know, the one over there. So thank you, everybody, for supporting us.
And, yes.
Let's get on with today's order of business. So three movies to talk about, but we've given ourselves some slack. So this will be a slightly longer podcast than you're used to, because we are going to include our regular segment, I can't find anything to watch on Netflix. Which,
it's a lie.
It's, I know, you know what?
There's that, too much stuff to
we
watch.
We started it because it was a common sentiment, right? Mm-hmm. People would come to us and say, what shall I watch on Netflix? Yep. Because I sit there and I scroll through for hours and never pick anything. And, you know, I have to admit, it's kind of fun to do that. But I find that, you know, there are some gems hidden out there that never seem to kind of surface in the interface. You scroll and you scroll, you never kind of see.
Yeah.
And you seem to run out of things to scroll through. We watch Netflix mainly on an Apple TV. So there's only so many, you know, they probably show you a couple hundred movies, but there are thousands in the catalog. Yeah. So
they're all just tucked away.
This is our opportunity to kind of help you. The algorithm tries to serve you what it thinks you would like, but maybe there's stuff in our queue that might be of interest. So
yeah, and we try to provide gems that we've really enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and especially those little film festival gems that never seem to make it to the big screen or have such a short stint on the cinema screen that you know, Netflix is a great way to you know, Netflix VOD, that kind of thing is a great way to surface those movies. But again, because they may have no name actors or a first time director, they never pop out. So this is what we try and do.
Mm-hmm.
And so what is in your queue this week?
Okay, I'm really excited to share mine. Mine is it's a movie called The Rover, and it's and I was just talking to Yazdi before we started the show, and it. And I wanted to mention how it was kind of the same. Oh, my goodness. It felt like it was in the same universe as Animal Kingdom that had Jackie Weaver in it. And I think she was actually nominated for an award.
Mm-hmm. Best supporting actress. Yeah.
Well, it turns out the director, David Mickard, actually directed Animal Kingdom too.
Mm.
Okay, so this is a brilliant movie. It's in a dystopian future, and it stars Robert Pattinson, and I think this was the first post vampire movie that he did, and it just does not feel like Robert Pattinson. So it's Robert Pattinson, Guy Pearce, Scoot McNairy, David Field, Anthony Hayes, Gillian Jones, and Susan Pryor. And believe it or not, it was screenwritten by Joel Egerton.
Oh, wow. Our favorite Joel Egerton.
So we didn't know that, right? So this was released like 4 years ago.
So we spoke about Joel Egerton in the last podcast.
Yeah, we did.
With my movie pick, The Gift. And I think he's been in like a ton of different stuff.
Yep.
Wow. So he's been really around.
He's been around for a long time. Anyway, The Rover is a great movie. It's very, I would describe it like... it feels very Americana, but it's set in Australia. Brilliant, like dusty movie. It's kind of a thriller. You don't really know what's going on. It's kind of a heist that's gone wrong, but you don't quite know how they got there. Brilliant.
I remember not loving it quite as much as you did, Rashmi, but it's a very good, it's a solid thriller.
Yeah, and I loved Animal Kingdom too, which came before it. So unfortunately, that's not available on Netflix yet.
That's too bad. Yes, Dee.
So continuing on remarkable English language movies made outside of America, my pick is going to be a British movie called Lock, L-O-C-K-E. And Lock is one of those movies which reminds you that this is what cinema can be as well. And like a few other movies, it's pretty much a one-man show. For 90 minutes, all you're going to get to see is Tom Hardy in a car driving. And he takes off from one location and he's headed to someplace in a hurry. And through a series of phone calls that he makes while he's in the car, the story slowly opens up like layers of an onion. And you get to understand this man more. And it plays beautifully with your expectations that you don't know whether this guy is a decent person or a villain. And kind of, you know, has you thinking a lot along the way as you're judgment of this individual changes, and you can't help but judge him because he's the only person on camera. It's really 90 minutes of a person driving a car during a crisis in his life where he's headed somewhere, how it impacts his family, how it impacts his work. Brilliant 2-4 performance from Tom Hardy, directed by Stephen Knight. Really highly recommended.
This is one of those movies that it reminds me of the movie we saw a couple of years ago with Ryan Reynolds in
Buried,
which we all love.
A man in a box for 90 minutes. Yeah. And this one is a man in a car for 90 minutes, which sounds dreadful. I mean, honestly, when you think about the idea that this movie has a single actor, we wonder how any kind of plot and drama can be created. And yet the movie is so effective through its use of dialogue, through Hardy's performance. Yeah, terrific pick.
And yours, Joe?
So, mine's not really a movie. It's
a banana.
Yeah. It's a piece of art.
It is a piece of art. It's Hans Zimmer live in Prague. Yeah. And it's the live concert recording of a tour that Hans Zimmer did about a year ago. He visited several cities and including a couple in the US, and San Diego was one of them. I'm a huge fan of movie music in general. I mean, you know, I listen to all sorts of music.
Especially Chris Nolan movies.
Well, Chris Nolan, but that's because he always uses Hans Zimmer, and I've been a fan of Hans Zimmer long before Nolan was using him. I mean, he has such an amazing back catalogue of movie soundtracks from, you know, Driving Miss Daisy, Crimson Tide, it's kind of interesting with movie music. There's a number of, you know, notable names. You have, you know, the James Horner and
John Williams.
John Williams and, you know, the American Beauty guy, that guy is, can't think of him.
Thomas
Newman.
Newman, thank you. And, you know, Hans Zimmer is another one of those that I will actually, you know, pay special attention to a movie that is scored by Zimmer.
Yeah.
Just because I love what he does with music. He's very good at the dramatic stuff as well as the kind of softer stuff. And we saw the concert about a year ago here in San Diego, and it was a phenomenal experience.
Fantastic.
I mean, I hope anyone out there that's a fan of movie music, you know, and was interested in seeing it, got a chance to see the tour while it was around, because it wasn't very well publicized, I thought.
Which is why. And if you didn't,
it's on Netflix.
It's the exact show.
They've recorded the whole show, and it's not quite the same as being there live, but it's a really good recording of it. They capture some of the more dramatic moments. So I'll save them. It is very much about the music. It's Hans Zimmer and his orchestra and a seemingly endless number of people on stage. He has a full choir, a full orchestra, and he toured with these people. He sometimes used local, but it's got a lot of movie favorites. Obviously, the Dark Knight trilogy.
The Thin Red Line was the one I loved.
Was very good.
Very good.
He scored the Thin Red Line, which was amazing. They had the Man of Steel music, the Gladiator theme, which is, again, one of my favorite scores. So check it out. Hans Zimmer, live in Prague. It's available on Netflix, and it's totally worth 90 minutes of your time. And
in fact, we got sucked in again.
I would recommend
some paperwork. And then Joe was like, let's put this on just to kind of drown out the noise. But then we got sucked in beat the purpose.
I kind of did it to be background, but the material is so engaging that I honestly think the best way to do it is, you know, sit down in a room, put some headphones on, or, you know, darken the room and focus on it, because it really does give you the experience of being there. So it's a really, really well-produced recording. So again, Hans Zimmer live in Prague. We have Rashmi's... Oh, sorry. Yazdi's pick, which was Lock.
L-O-C-K-E.
And Lock. Rashmi, Locky.
The Rover.
The Rover. Terrific. Plenty to watch on Netflix and other streaming services, so no excuse if you can't get out to the movies. Do check one of those out. All right, so we better get on because we have three movies to talk about. They are Mission Impossible, Christopher Robin, and Black Klansman. I think we've both seen the first two of those, right? And Yazdi, I think you weren't able to make the daytime screening of Black Klansman.
Because they only had a screening in the day.
I actually took a day, a vacation day, to watch it because I was so excited to watch this.
So, should we start with...
Why don't we start with Christopher Robin?
Okay, let's do that then.
Okay, a working-class family man now, Christopher Robin encounters a childhood friend, Winnie the Pooh, who helps him rediscover the joys of life. This is directed by Mark Foster, and it's written by Alex Ross Perry, Tom McCarthy, Alison Schroeder, but it's based on a story by Greg Brooker and Mark Steven Johnson. Of course, it's based on the original characters, which were beloved and written by A.A. Milne, and it stars Ewan McGregor as Christopher Robin, Jim Cummings, Hayley Atwell, Toby Jones, Brad Garrett, and Peter Capaldi.
Why am I blanking out? The British show, the sci-fi...
Doctor Who.
Doctor Who. He played Doctor Who for several seasons.
He is Rabbit in this. So is this worth your time? Joe, you look very ready to start.
I am and I'm not. I mean, I think my feelings about this movie are readily summarized by saying it was okay. I mean... I'm not a huge fan of the Winnie the Pooh universe. It's something that, as a kid, I guess, I never got the book at the right moment in childhood to kind of fall in love with the stories, as many people do. And I understand why these characters are so beloved, but they're not especially beloved to me. And so, as a result, you know, the movies and the animations and all the fuss about Winnie the Pooh is not quite on my wavelength, but nonetheless, I thought this movie was very well executed. It had its moments that I thought were, you know, it was a parable, right? Is, you know, work less, spend more time with your family kind of movie. And I thought the moments of Pooh and the various characters interacting with the real world and in the Hundred Acre Wood were very well done. I think there were some very beautiful moments, and I think for the first time I kind of understood the wisdom of Pooh. Right, I never got that before in any of the movies. I thought he was just kind of a cute soft talking bear, but there's wisdom in those words, and I think that movie got that across very well. So it was an okay film. It's definitely one that I'd recommend for family viewing. Not necessarily one that's going to remain with me for much longer after this podcast.
Yazdi. Now, did you read Pooh when you were younger?
I did. Maybe not all of it, but I read a couple of books when I was maybe in... It's a very curious film because so off the bat, I like it. I like it a lot. I would recommend it. And I think I didn't realize this until you explicitly mentioned this, Joe. But yeah, this is a movie that you can recommend for family viewing. Although by the same token, I agree with everything you've said. By the same token, the movie has a sense of melancholy through
most of it.
It starts in a place of sadness and it kind of maintains that. And I think the feeling through the entire movie is one of you have to eventually grow up and you have to eventually, make hard decisions. But that is not reason for you to forget your childhood. I think, Tigger and Eeyore and Pooh and everybody represent, I think, your innocence of childhood, innocence in sense of your morals, innocence in the way of seeing the world in simpler terms. And I think the movie kind of at its best harkens back to kind of embracing that and not have become cynical when you've grown up. But to kind of carry that message across, it I think is pretty dark, through parts. So that I was kind of surprised by. The other thing I want to mention is that the previous incarnations of Pooh, which have been mostly animated, all the mm-hmm. creatures look animated. In this movie, they very curiously made a choice to make them all look like stuffed animals, which seems like a very odd choice, but it kind of actually grows on you because you kind of see them as living, talking, stuffed animals. And I again, it was a very gutsy thing to do,
mm-hmm.
But it works. And, you know, just to put this movie in context, and we can talk more about it, I compared this movie right from the start when I saw Pooh for the first time to something like Paddington. And I've seen Paddington 1 and Paddington 2, and both of those movies are absolutely etched in my mind. Paddington 2 is one of my favorite movies of this year. This one will not be. So right. It's not that class. It's not in that category, even emotionally or visually. But for what it is, it's pretty remarkable.
So I think this movie does a beautiful job of creating nostalgia for those of us who are a certain age. But overall, it's not a good movie because for me, it remains too stoic. Yes, you use the word melancholy. For me, it's stoic. Mm. It made me extremely emotional, right? So I actually had tears rolling down my eyes. I don't know if either of you saw.
I did,
yeah.
But the emotion came from a place of how easily we abandon our childhood. As opposed to, oh, it's so sad that Christopher Robin's grown up and he's forgotten his friends. I just think it's too cold as a movie. And I think it's terribly cast. I didn't buy Ewan McGregor as a grown-up Christopher Robin. And I didn't like Pooh's voice. That's
really?
Not how I imagined Pooh speaking. Yeah, and I read a lot of Pooh growing up. And I actually have a book on our bookshelf called The Tower of Pooh. Pooh is so wise, right? Pooh is kind of like the original Yoda to me.
Pooh sounds like an old woman. In the movie.
Yeah, and that's not how
does he
I
sound
wanted.
In the animated movies? Because he sounded spot
it's
on.
It's exactly like that in the animated
okay,
movies.
Okay.
But when I first saw... Go ahead.
No, go on.
The voice of Pooh, the first time I saw it on screen, never matched what I
had
in my head.
Correct.
Never.
Yeah. And I think that casting is central to the movie, so I didn't think it was very, very well cast. But an example is, look, I had a penguin growing up. A penguin who I dearly loved, I even took him to university. If my penguin...
Not a real one, I hope.
If my penguin appeared to me in San Diego in my office, I would literally poo my pants.
Right.
Christopher Robin was very cool with poo just appearing on a bench in London. So...
Well, in fairness, he wasn't. He freaked out at first.
but what I'm saying is that reaction is sort of... It's representative of the movie.
Sure.
Right?
Okay.
I mean, it just didn't have the emotion. Like, if I met my penguin, I would like cry and hug it.
I see. Okay.
You know,
so you thought he was too cold.
Yeah, it was just very cold and distant. I felt very cold and distant.
I kind of, that's a deliberate, I'm not sure if it's deliberate or if it's just an oversight. I almost saw it as a reflection of how far he had come from his childhood,
sure.
That he failed to connect with something.
Yeah.
That he was so...
he just wanted the bear to go away.
Had been
away.
Closed off.
Yeah.
And he was so... like this wall had been built around him. But yeah.
What do you think kids will make of this? Because, I mean, obviously it's a character that's you know, aimed at children in some ways.
I mean, I think they'll find something to like about it. And look, I talk about it. I'm doing a joke. I'm talking about it like I hated the movie and I didn't hate it. I just wanted so much more from it, given this was, you know, a rendering of a man in his adulthood meeting the friends who he grew up with.
Mm.
And imaginary or not, you know, it didn't spark that joy for me. It wasn't joyful. But I think the calamity and the physical humor of the movie will entice kids enough. And certainly there were a lot of kids in the screening that we were in.
Mm-hmm.
And they seemed to enjoy and laugh.
They seemed very engaged.
Yeah, they seemed very
from
engaged.
My perspective.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that they were, you know, having fun with like lots of gags and jokes, but they seemed very drawn to the characters, which I think is half the challenge here.
And I was just really happy that a red balloon isn't something sinister like it is in It. So I'm really happy that the red balloon has made a comeback.
I was
going
to ask if that was a deliberate reference to kind of, you know,
no, I think,
by
I
the
think,
red balloon
I
sales
think
company.
I think Pooh predates Stephen King.
Yeah, I do too.
Or A.A. Milne predates Stephen King.
Okay. Maybe that's why it used the red balloon.
Probably.
Because it was a way to draw children in
correct.
Based on the lore of Pooh.
Yeah.
Yeah, about Ewan McGregor, I mean, you wake me up at 2 o'clock in the night and you ask me to join the Ewan McGregor parade, and I will do that. I will bring my cymbals and drums. So I'm a complete fan of him, but I agree with you. He is miscast here. I don't know who else I would cast. But, you know, Christopher Robin in the books is somebody who is, you know, philosophical as a child, who's trying to figure out right from wrong, and he's learning about friendship. And the way he's played, I don't know, it just didn't feel right to me. The adult Ewan McGregor didn't seem to me connected with the storybooks that I had read as a child. Somehow there seemed to be a disconnect. Like, you know, the third part of Moonlight seemed to me like a totally different actor than the first two parts. So it kind of was a disconnect.
Don't be on Moonlight.
I won't be on Moonlight.
In a Pooh Bear movie.
The other thing I wanted to mention was that it's interesting that, you know, ostensibly this is a movie about kids, and we were just talking about this, but I think the central message of the movie is very much for adults.
Yes.
That, you know, it is only when you do nothing that it leads to the best of something. And it's kind of urging all of us to kind of not be so consume minute by minute in the everyday life that we've forgotten to just rest and kind of, you know, take in the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, I mean, that's a message which really resonates for me. So I really like that piece, but I don't think any, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 12 year old is going to probably get that too much.
And, you know, I mean, a lot of my favorite kids films, you know, have that duality, right? You know, kids and adults that see completely different movies. And this might be one of them, right? You know, right, I think, as again, we saw the kids very engaged by the animated characters here, and maybe less able to relate to the adult story going on. But that's fine, because parents take their kids to see movies too, and they should be able to enjoy that.
Yeah, I was trying to think of the movie, like Donald Gleason, mm-hmm. I think would have been a great Christopher Robin, but he was just in the movie Goodbye Christopher Robin last year.
Right.
But I think, to me, that sort of very lean, very quiet, reflective type of contemporary actor would have been a far better Christopher Robin than Ewan McGregor. He's just so badly cast for me.
And Hayley Atwell, who plays his wife, she's too young to be playing, you know, mom to two kids. She's Captain America's
wife.
She had
one kid. Yeah, and I didn't even like the kid. I mean, I was sort of just not connected with the movie at all. I did like the production. I think the production
design
really
is excellent.
Good.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I did like how the toys have been sort of, they're almost bobbly and raggedy, mm-hmm. and they look like they've been played with. That was a really good choice.
Mm-hmm.
Again, a bit muted. Like, I wanted the colors to be a bit brighter. Like Tigger, I wanted to be orange. Tigger's always orange in all the colorful illustrations. But Piglet was so cute. I just wanted to hug them all.
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, one of the things that I, not being a big fan of this particular universe, got from the movie was just how the imbued characteristic of each. You know, that Piglet was fearful of heffalumps, and that, you know, Kanga and Roo was always asking the questions, you know, that very innocently.
Yeah.
And so they were wonderfully rendered.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Eeyore is properly depressed.
Yeah.
You know, so.
I was going to say, that was so.
Brad Garrett was great.
He was great
voice.
Yeah.
Well, he was just Brad Garrett, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And I thought that was the one voice that I decoupled from the character, just because it's so characteristically Brad Garrett.
Yeah. That was a good Brad Garrett. Okay, let's wrap this one up. So, Yazdi, you go first.
6 out of 10. It's a good. It's not a bad movie. It's a good movie. It has really, really good intentions. I love how it's been physically rendered. Like I said, the production design is exquisite.
Yeah.
At times, it does get a little bit twee, but I think, the end message of the movie really resonated for me. I think everybody will get something out of it. I can't think of anybody I would not recommend this to. A slightly stingy 6 out of 10. Again, nowhere nearly on par with what was accomplished with the Paddington movies.
Yeah.
That's just a whole other level.
Joe?
Another 6 from me as well. I mean, I think the movie's reasonably well executed. It didn't reach me emotionally, but I think everyone will get something out of it. And, you know, again, I mentioned it earlier, but it is very much a parable that, you know, in the vein of, you know, many a Christmas movie is kind of predictable. So, you know, again, you know, nice family viewing, but, you know, not a classic.
Yeah, I was going to say, if it's a rainy afternoon, a really rainy afternoon, or you're looking to escape from the AC and sit in a cinema and cool down, and there's absolutely nothing else on, watch this. For me, it's a 5 out of 10. Very average.
Wow.
I wanted this to be so much more, although it really made me cry.
Okay.
I think, by the way, Mike Nichols should sue them, because the last ending of the movie is straight out of The Working Girl. That's all I
was. Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, I don't remember that.
Yeah. But anyway.
I mean, it's very reminiscent of a lot of movies.
Okay, two more movies, Mission Impossible and Black Klansman.
Black Klansman.
Okay, so Yasti, I think you're going to tell us about this.
Mission Impossible.
Yes, definitely. So Black Klansman is the latest from
Spike Lee. Yeah.
So it's a Spike Lee joint, as all of his movies are called. And this particular movie is, I think, one of his rare movies which is based on an actual event, because most of his movies are, you know, fictional. And I love that the poster for the movie says, based on a crazy, outrageous, incredible true story. And the story in question, which is just mind-boggling that this is something which is set 60 years ago, is still relevant right now. And it's the story of Ron Stallworth, an African-American police officer from Colorado, who successfully managed to infiltrate the local Ku Klux Klan and become the head of the local chapter of the Ku Klux Klan. And this one comes with a lot of fanfare. It did exceptionally well at the spring film festivals where it was shown. And it has a crackerjack cast, which includes Alec Baldwin, John David Washington, who is Denzel Washington's son. It also has Adam Driver, who has not been in a bad film as far as I'm concerned, as well as Topher Grace, who we haven't seen in a long time. And I think the last film that Spike Lee made was Chirac, which I really liked, even though it was so rough around the edges and kind of a little wobbly. But
I'm really
looking forward to this one, and I'm sorry I missed the screening, because they, in their great wisdom, decided to have it only during the day. But as soon as it's released, I'm going to rush out and watch it. So tell me, should I run fast, or it's okay if I just do a even run?
Yeah. So. Oh, the cookies were really good. Yasti bought some cookies around.
He bought four, one for each 100 episodes of Movie Wallace.
Yes. Yeah.
And they are on our Instagram.
They are on the Instagram.
In our bellies.
And our bellies. Stuffed mine through my mouth and tried to suck on it really quickly. Okay, so remember when we came out of Get Out, some of us knew that we'd seen something really special.
Mm.
That's how I feel about this movie.
Wow.
Spike Lee delivers in droves. And where he ends, the charmingly wonderful John David Washington takes over. And he's helped out a lot by Adam Driver and Topher Grace. This is a well-made, well-paced, high-tension, important story that I'm sad to say, like you said, Yazdi, is incredibly important and relevant to today. Most important, it's entertaining and it's very comedic. As it should be, I think. Bravo, 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 and welcome back, Spike Lee. This is incredible.
I mean, this is the same David Duke from the movie that we are talking about right now in 2017. Correct. This movie played out in 1957.
Correct.
Anyway.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't true, you'd be sort of scratching your head and thinking, this is an amazing story. This would never have happened.
Well, I mean, the central theme of this is irony, right? The Black Klansman. And I think the movie, you know, embraces that irony all the way throughout its running time with humor that's brought out of these, you know, remarkable, ridiculous, based on a true story type. And I'm actually curious to kind of research how much of the events are kind of, you know, created for, you know, comedic purpose on camera, and how many of them are true. But
apparently, I mean, most until the very end.
I believe it. Yeah. I mean, I think that the hilarious, you know, Ron Stallworth is clearly a spiky character, and the book, the movie is based on his book, so correct. It's very much told from his perspective. And you know, as a police officer, essentially, you know, launching an investigation against the Klan by, you know, impersonating a Klan's member, it's just a remarkable thing that he kind of, you know, was able to execute here. But the movie never takes itself too seriously, even though it has some very serious moments in it. I think it's got some very serious messages. Spike Lee can be very hit or miss for me, and mm-hmm. I think when he misses, which is unfortunately for me more often than not,
correct me too.
You know, they're really kind of missed opportunity, because you think, you know, the premise here is terrific. Here he nails it. I mean, he's got, you know, gold with which he can mine, and he does. He exploits the idea, the concepts behind this movie brilliantly well. He casts the movie incredibly well. He doesn't do any of those gimmicky Spike Lee type camera movements. So there's no, you know, people walking down the sidewalk, you know, side by side with a camera kind of following. There's none of that nonsense.
Or breaking of the fourth wall or anything that
right.
he's done.
So it feels very traditional. It doesn't in many ways feel like a Spike Lee movie. But yeah, terrific stuff. It gets rather political at the end. And I always get frustrated when movies get so political. He's very clear about his political persuasions, because I find that it might be off-putting to an audience that might otherwise be enlightened by it. I feel like, you know, there will be a certain contingent of, I'll just say, you know, the right-leaning folks will have a hard time with this movie simply because...
And they should.
Well, right. But I mean, this is a frustrating thing about the polarization of politics in America today. I think there are people who would, you know, have a couple of light bulb moments by seeing something like this, but won't, because it has a very strong political message, particularly in its last 10 minutes.
Yeah, I think, remember how much I gushed about Sorry to Bother You?
Mm-hmm.
This is even better than that. That's
thank you, yes.
Too absurd, right? We said this during that show. That sells a similar message in some ways, but it's hidden behind absurd, and I don't think that's for everyone. Mm-hmm. In fact, I don't think it's for many people. This is not like that. This is not in your face, but like you said, Joe, the politics of the movie are completely on show. They're not hidden at all. But I think the cleverness of this movie is that each of the characters, especially that of Ron Stallworth, is so incredibly likable. Even the bad characters are likable in some way.
That's very true.
Right? So you feel even the horrible, crazy ones, there's something very likable and enjoyable to watch about them. And they feel so well formed that even when a character comes on screen for just two lines, you know who that person is. You know their background story, and you know what they're there to represent.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very smart about this movie. And
can I just interject? Because I mean, that's a great point. It's very sympathetic to its bad guys, and it's sympathetic in the sense of it doesn't portray them as evil as it does stupid. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's a kind of comic stupidity about the Klansmen in this movie that. They're kind of likable, right? These are kind of, you know, nice guys who are misguided in the most horrible way.
Yeah.
But there's a goofy, that's a really, really funny observation, because I never found myself thinking this person is despicable and needs to go to jail immediately forever. Even though they get themselves into some ridiculous, quite violent capers.
Correct.
But they all feel like bungling.
Correct. But even the ones that aren't bungling, I feel like although it's not fair necessarily and it's not a very balanced portrayal of them, that would be an interesting movie, just for us to those of us who aren't sympathetic to their cause.
Well, they self-parody them, you know. I mean, if you watch any real behind-the-scenes thing about the Klansmen, you know, there are those that
the
are frightening
people
and evil.
But it's done in a really, I think, as balanced as it can be, and I think that. It's going to be a lightning rod. Look, I think it's a lightning rod for what's happening now. And I think it's interesting that many in the movie are actually still alive today. And in fact, I actually was really fascinated and did some reading because I couldn't believe that it was real. And I wanted to kind of find out more about it and how they pulled everything off. And remember that we're told during the movie that they were told to rip up everything related to the case. And so actually David Duke has denied this ever happening,
as I'm sure he would.
Of course he will, because it makes him look not so great. But even the way that Topher Grace has portrayed David Duke is pretty good. I mean, it does make you, I hate to say I'm sympathetic to him, but it starts to give you an understanding of where the thought comes from, right or wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, again,
and that's really difficult to. Yeah, I'm shocked. I'm shocked that Spike Lee did it.
And again, I'm saying this without having seen the movie, although I would have loved to have seen this movie while we are discussing it. But maybe the point he's making is that, and I often notice this, is that it's when evil is hiding in plain sight, when it's amongst the banal and everyday, is when it's the.
Yes.
You know, chilling. You know, if somebody came out like looking like a monster, you'd be like, oh my God, monster, kill him. But if it was somebody who looks like your uncle or your brother or whatever, and they are doing things, then that's, you know, harder for us to kind of reconcile these two aspects of, because in every other aspect, they're just completely normal, you know, but regular people.
Yeah. I mean, maybe that's, you know, we described it a little wrong. I mean, I think, yes, I agree with that statement wholeheartedly. I don't know that that's what this movie is doing. Maybe it is, and maybe that point was lost on me. But I think it's really... to me, its deepest message is ignorance and education, you know. It's and lack of, you know. I mean, honestly, I think to me, it just feels like... oftentimes people aren't necessarily driven at their core by some belief. They're just kind of part of a gang, you know, that, you know,
they're accepted by a certain group of people.
It's kind of what we do, right? Yeah. You know, we don't like black people. I don't know why, but we just hate them. You know, there's this kind of, anyway, but you know, maybe.
Is it an angry film? Because, you know, his best films and his worst films have been very angry films, like Do the Right Thing and Crooklyn and Jungle Fever and, you know, all of these movies, even Inside Man.
Malcolm X.
They're very angry movies. And I think he does best when he kind of, as a filmmaker, you know, when he's demonstrating this indignation, like righteous indignation. This is what's happening. You know, homes are burning, streets are burning. This is not an angry film, then.
I would say it's a restrained, appropriate angerness that will definitely leave, you know, you will leave the theater. If you are not sympathetic to the cause, then you will leave the cinema angry. And especially because of the bit at the end.
I was going to say, I mean...
That's the piece that I think is the twister.
It's a very restrained movie. Mm. And then it all comes out in the last 15 minutes. And
we won't know what that 15 minutes
but,
is.
But the kind of thing that you're talking about there, Yazdi, where he kind of unleashes his true feelings, is left till the end of this movie. And it's done with a montage. It's done with kind of, you know, some...
I was going to say, don't
let's
say
not
enough.
Talk to, yeah. But it emerges at the end, and I think... You know, a lot of what's been written about the movie, I think, is captured by that ending. So, you know, when I look down at the critics' consensus here on Rotten Tomatoes, you know, there's a lot of, you know, impassioned and angry and you know, we need its anger right now. You know, it's an angry...
Right.
And it's actually not. In my opinion, it felt very...
comedic. Dramedy.
Constrained. ironic. Mm. You know, it, again, for me, the central theme is irony.
Which is good, because I think off late, some of his movies which have not worked is because he's let his anger get the better of him.
Yeah.
You know, no, so I think...
I mean, that's why Chirac for me failed, but this isn't a podcast about Chirac. I just wanted to get a dig into Yazdi because he liked it.
I did. And by the way, he's made a movie, he's made for Amazon, I think, he's, or maybe Netflix, he's did this 10-episode series called She's Gotta Have It, which is based on the movie She's Gotta Have It, which was one of these early movies that he made.
Okay.
And I've always wanted to see it, but I haven't gotten around to doing so. But so he hasn't been twiddling his thumbs.
No.
He's been very busy.
I mean, I can wind this one up. Look, it's hard to anger and entertain, and it's even harder to make a movie that talks about now that was written in the past. Black Klansman delivers. It delivers the most since the death of Stalin for me. 10 out of 10. I love this movie, and I can't wait to go and see this guy. I want to see this again.
I had no idea you liked it that much. That's amazing.
Such a groovy movie.
So I like this very much as well. I mean, I don't think it stands up to some of his best works. And again, you know, for me, those are movies like Jungle Fever and Do the Right Thing. I think it lacks the kind of bite that those movies do until the end, where it's, you know, it's just teeth everywhere. But, you know, I struggle to give this a 9. So I'm going to give it an 8. But it's kind of one of those 8.75s that is rounded down. It just doesn't... It has its message, but it doesn't feel especially remarkable. But, you know, there we go. 8 out of 10, a solid viewing. And I'm going to stew on this for a while. I think I knocked a point off because everything did come at the end in the way that it did. And I like things to be a little less biased politically. I want people to kind of make their own opinions.
Came on the desk.
So, yes. So, I'm sure the cat's on one of the cameras here. We have plenty of cameras lurking around. So, yes, welcome, Kelly, to the podcast. You're on video, you know.
You're a star.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on then to movie number 3 of the week, which is Mission Impossible Fallout. And I'm going to try and do the almost impossible task of introing this movie. So, in the lead-up to Mission Impossible Fallout... I said to Rashmi and Yazdi, because both of you have been huge fans of this series, I've always found them entertaining but completely disposable. So I found myself thinking, I don't recall what any of the movies are about. I asked Yazdi, and he was able to recall the plots of the various ones.
Really? Honestly,
all I can remember from any of them is, you know, Tom Cruise on a string, Tom Cruise on a building, Tom Cruise underwater.
Absolutely. Cliff.
So, you know, I just didn't remember what any of them about. They all felt like, you know, gobbledygook spy stuff. So, I kind of...
Didn't we watch the... Mission Impossible movies in 7
IGN,
minutes.
Yeah, IGN.com, which is a website that I follow on various kind of entertainment stuff, had like a Mission Impossible in 5 minutes type review, and it reminded me roughly of what was going on, but still felt like mostly nonsense. So this is the latest entry in that series, obviously starring Tom Cruise. It also was written and directed by Christopher McQuarrie, which apparently, I didn't know this, but is the first time a director has been invited back to do a second MI movie. So he also directed Mission Impossible Rogue Nation.
Which was the Burj
preceding one.
I think it was the last one, but
the last one,
they've kind of famously hopped from director to director because they've never wanted to, they've wanted each movie to have its own unique feel. But he was invited back to do this next entry. The movie stars Tom Cruise, Henry Cavill, Ving Rhames, Simon Pegg, Rebecca Ferguson, Sean Harris, Angela Bassett, of course, Angela Bassett, Alec Baldwin, Wes Bentley. There's a huge star cast in Michelle Monaghan. There's a huge cast in this movie. And I'm just going to read its Rotten Tomatoes praise. I am able to describe the plot of this one a little better from memory, but I'll go with what it says
here. Memory. No.
The best intentions often come back to haunt you. Mission Impossible Fallout finds Ethan Hunt and his IMF team, along with some familiar allies, in a race against time after a mission gone wrong. That's...
Well, that's specific.
That's very, yeah.
I think that's all that needs to be said. So, why don't you guys tell me
first
what you think of Mission Impossible Fallout?
Yeah, I think...
As you abseil down the walls.
Is that what?
Cling to the microphone. Oh,
actually, there is something I want to mention. Much has been made of the fact that Tom Cruise does his own stunts in this movie. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether it's a promotional effort behind this movie or whether it's a YouTube channels to which I subscribe, but I've seen a ton of behind the scenes footage of him doing his own stunts, flying helicopters.
Infamously, he told Henry Cavill that he couldn't do one, apparently.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know about that. But yeah, he broke his ankle, but he jumped out of planes, you know. So a lot of what we do see on screen in this movie is Tom Cruise. It's not a stunt double. It's not a lookalike. Well, let's talk about that. So, sorry to interrupt you, Yeti.
I think Joe's doing what Yazdi did to Joe the other week. Remember when you wouldn't let him speak? Now you're not letting Yazdi speak.
No, that's quite all right.
I keep thinking of things to add.
It's not even your turn yet.
Birthday Yazdi is dead.
Birthday Yazdi's gone. Joe,
hey, wait.
Joe killed him. Yeah. Birthday Joe killed Birthday Yazdi.
This is our 400th episode. I'm allowing myself to indulge.
You may indulge.
Sure.
So I always say that everything that ails Hollywood right now can be put in one word, which is sequels. And I hate sequels, and I hate that, you know, people have become lazy and we keep going and watching the same thing over and over again. And I'm tired of, you know, Predator is being remade, and, you know, I'm tired of just the same thing over and over again.
There's no original content.
And it seems like the big studios only want to invest in property which, you know, people are already familiar with. They're just playing it safe, essentially. But I think the only series for which I make an exception to my own feeling is the Mission Impossible films. Some of the Fast and Furious movies off and on have been pretty good, in their later incarnations. But I think, Cruise started off with... the original was directed by Brian De Palma, and then the second one was directed by John Chu. The third one was directed by J.J. Abrams, who has been a producer on everyone since then. And then fourth one was done by Brad Bird. That Brad Bird, you know, from Pixar. And then fifth and sixth are done with Christopher McQuarrie. So these are, you know, high top-notch filmmakers that he enlists to make these movies. And I think in particular the last three, Ghost Protocol,
Rogue Nation,
and now Fallout, I think those three form a really good trilogy of exceptional craft in filmmaking. And I think this one in particular, it has just absolute gobbledygook for plot. Okay, it's nonsense. It's just nonsense, nonsense, nonsense.
Aren't they all?
Well, I don't know. Some, like the one last one where Rebecca Ferguson's character was introduced in Rogue Nation, I thought the story of that held together really well. There's that scene in the opera house, and I can kind of play all the scenes in my head because it all sticks together. This one I've seen twice now. I saw it at the screening, and then I saw it again on Friday.
Not with MoviePass, though.
Not with MoviePass. We'll talk about that.
We keep promising to speak about MoviePass.
But... the plot is just nonsense. I'm really, really disappointed that they couldn't be bothered to, you know, make something a little bit tighter. But I put that all aside and I just look at the movie as its need to entertain you. And I think in its need to entertain you, it's at the pinnacle. It's really something else. I mean, there is... a lot of people have already done this in their reviews for Mission Impossible Fallout by comparing it, of all things, to The Last Mad Max. But I wouldn't make, in terms of, you know, how great the action
Fury
is.
Road. Oh, okay.
Fury Road. But I wouldn't go that far. But what I would say is, like that movie, this one uses so little CGI, or it seems to use so little CGI, that everything looks real to me. I mean, that's Tom Cruise running, that's Tom Cruise on the motorbike without... a helmet, that's Tom Cruise jumping out of a plane in a single take as he's flying down, coming down without a parachute. Flying a helicopter, helicopter stuck in a mountain, whatever. It makes you feel, it made me anxious because it felt so real. And I think therein lies, you know, the reason why it's made more money right now than any other previous Mission Impossible movie. It's just a fine, fine piece of craft. Rashmi?
Great action sequences, lots of double and triple crossing, the old gang back together again, face masks a la Scooby-Doo, breathless and thrilling helicopter sequences. Can I remember what happened in terms of story?
You should watch it again.
No way! But will you have a terrific time at the movies? Hell yeah. You will, and you'll be excited when the next Mission Impossible sequel comes out. I love this movie.
Yeah.
There's nothing not to love. Is it memorable? Who cares? It's just great.
And it's hard to make a sixth
movie. We're not going to let Joe speak now.
It's hard to make a sixth movie in a franchise.
You can tell from his face. And luckily our viewers can see now, viewers and listeners,
yes,
can see the disdain on his face already.
But how often can you see that?
Yeah.
Say it's bona fide great sixth entry into a franchise.
The only thing I'll say is that,
and I have many problems with it.
You know, like Bourne Identity, James Bond, all of the other, you know, ones except John Wick. This stands out.
Yeah.
This feels like the bar.
I think it's clear that of this franchise, I'm the one that's liked this the least of all of the movie wallers. I think Rogue Nation, others, they always felt like capers, but I never knew what was going on. And I'm surprised that the two of you are saying that the plot of this one seems like gobbledygook, because it's the only one that I've ever been able to follow. There are some missing nuclear cores that can make a bomb, and they follow them around the world. There's nothing more
it's
to it than
that.
It's
very similar to the last Marvel movie to me.
But there's none of this kind of, you know, double-crossing intrigue.
What's with the White Widow, and what's with all that? I didn't understand.
What's going
I saw
on with
it
that?
Twice. I still don't understand the White Widow.
Three nuclear warheads. That's
they're the middlemen.
That's all of the rest of the stuff is nonsense. This is a pursuit movie, right? So for me, the plot kind of held together coherently. And I'm going to say this right now. I mean, this is the best of the series as far as I'm concerned.
Really?
Yeah, I loved every moment of this movie. It clicks together so perfectly. So I hadn't heard the Fury Road comparisons, but now that you mentioned it, it's absolutely the same thing. It's a number of well-executed action set pieces, one after the other. Strung together with a wonderful story. I think the performances in this are excellent, and
wonderful story, really.
I thought this.
Really,
I really enjoyed this.
From the man who didn't like Sorry to Bother You,
right?
What?
And he finds this. Yeah. Okay, no, go on, please. Go on.
My favorite entry in this by far. It's probably going to be in my top five movies of the year. I mean, I just thought this was, I can't wait to see it again. I think the stunt sequences were very engaging, but I didn't feel like they were there as filler for plot. I think the movie is very well crafted around these amazingly choreographed stunt sequences. I was never lost. I never knew who was after who, and never lost sight of who was after who and for what
care.
And for when. And
didn't care.
I smiled at the ridiculousness of, you know, a particular battle on the side of a cliff, but I never lost sight of what was. The objective, and there wasn't a moment where I didn't really believe in what was happening either, despite the ridiculousness of it all. You know, falling out of a plane without, you know, doing a halo jump, one of those high altitude, low opening kind of parachute jump. I never lost sight of any of that. I thought it was terrific.
Yeah, I just, how do you build on this? How do you do a next one?
More of the same.
I mean,
it's the only thing you can do.
And I just, I mean, it's just so enjoyable. And I love that they don't even take themselves so seriously. It felt like the first few were very serious. And I think, Joe, when we were going through that 7-minute what happened, I think I realized there were actually two in the middle that I didn't watch, two or three in the middle. But the last three have been so fun.
So satisfying.
I love the humor. And Simon Pegg is... is great in them, and the and I'm always like looking for who's wearing the mask and how they use that gimmick is so fun.
Well, there's always a moment that they always pull it off where you see a scene and the scene isn't what the scene appears to be.
Oh, there's always that there's a fake artifice, that something has been created. Yeah,
and I love that the timing of that particular device in this movie
is so wise.
Was really well done.
It was
because
so good. Yeah,
I didn't see it coming, and I did have the jaw drop when the reveal came. Yeah. So I thought,
and it comes, and it's a quick one, right? Like it's instant gratification as soon as you're there. I mean, as soon as the music starts, as soon as the credits start running at the beginning, I'm so thrilled.
Yeah, that original Laszlo
score. Was it thrilling when you watched it the second time, even though you knew what was coming?
Yeah, although because I was just trying to understand
what you watched a week ago.
No, it did. I mean, that original Laszlo score, I don't know, I can't do it. It's so good.
Yeah, it's so good.
And, you know, he's been hiring other music directors to kind of take on that riff and do it better. And in this one, they use a lot of drums. There's a lot of drumming, but it's the same. When you have like something gold like that, then you can just try it with different instruments and it still works really well. You know, I have a lot of quips with the movie. I mean, what's going on with that, you know, Henry Cavill porn stash? I mean, what was that? It was so weird. And, you know, I don't know. It was.
That's the thing that bothered you.
That bothered me. And the other thing which really bothered me is this is a movie in 2018, right?
Yeah.
This is supposed to be the epitome of high tech and high, you know, he jumps out of things and whatever. And what is the ending left to? The ending is left to cutting the red wire very closely while you're cutting the green wire and you're turning screws counterclockwise. Really? In 2018, we're still talking about detonating bombs. And I know that there's no other device that we know of which creates more tension than, you know, bomb which is going to go off in 10 seconds or whatever. And they even joke about it. You know, they're like, oh, yeah, this one, you know, the two are attached. Once it starts, you cannot stop it. But I was a little dismayed, like, come on.
But, I think if everything was technological, then it would just be such a boring movie.
Right.
The fact that you have to do something physical and the stakes are so high at that point makes it so much more enjoyable to watch.
Right.
And, of course, you know nothing's going to happen, right? And well, I mean, you know.
Well, this is the thing. I mean,
unless you're in the Marvel universe.
I was going to say, we know that the IMF is going to prevail, right? Tom Cruise, an Ethan Hawke character. And that's the wonderful thing about the way. Ethan Hunt, thank you. Ethan Hawke.
Ethan Hawke is in another movie.
I know, that sounds like more of an action movie hero name, doesn't it? Ethan Hawke.
But Taken.
Ethan Hunt does. You know, the movie constantly sets up those moments where you have, you know, a set of circumstances from which there appeared to be no exit. And Ethan Hunt comes along and he's like, oh, okay, I got this, guys. He doesn't know what he's going to do, but he's like, I've got this. And you trust in him to have this. And he always has this. So you're right.
Great.
There's never going to be any real sense of the mission failing. But that's what's so fun about the movie.
But it comes dangerously close.
Because it constantly looks like it's about to fall apart. And they manage that so well, because everything that they do appears to go wrong, and there's a good dose of luck involved, but you know, at the end of the day, it always comes together. And but it's that skill of being able to retain the tension, even though we all know that there is no way that the nuclear warheads are going to fall into the wrong hands and destroy the Earth, you know.
Yeah, you know, and Tom Cruise is a very particular movie presence, right? He's always been this charmer with a little smugness about him.
Mm.
And, you know, you want to almost slap that, you know, smirk off his face. And I think he works best off late when he's able to use that, you know, towards the
absolutely,
plot. Like, he made this movie that I loved last year called American Maid, remember? Where he played this.
I loved that movie.
Yeah, it was so good. Where he kind of uses the smugness to depict a character who was like unbelievable. If somebody told us that this was real, you wouldn't believe it. And here again, we are seeing Tom Cruise in the sixth decade of his life. He's 56 in this movie.
He looks amazing.
And he looks beaten up, but he also looks like somebody who has seen a lot and weathered through a lot. And, you know, when he gets punched up nice and good, you know, in this movie. So I think it really works with him, works for him as an actor. And I think the other thing which people don't talk about really is the fact that, you know, Hunt has his own morality, right? He does not understand, or maybe he understands, but he's not able to abide by the concept of sacrificing one life to save millions. For him, the one life is just as important as millions. And maybe I'm making too much of it.
Well, and that's his Achilles heel, right? Well, that's what's exploited in this movie.
And every movie it kind of plays to that he is not going to give up one of his own at great peril to everything else, which makes things more complicated. And that gives the movie a nice little weight. And I think the other good thing that Christopher McQuarrie has done is that he's kind of gone back and kind of... Because through the last few movies, Ethan Hunt was kind of a cipher. He was just showing up and doing incredible things. And now he's kind of rooting him back to his previous life and, you know, the wife he had to leave behind and so forth. So, I don't know. Overall, it seems a more stable kind of endeavor.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just looking at his IMDb. I mean, the guy is... He's relentless, right? I mean, Jack Reacher... Edge of Tomorrow. I'm just picking out the ones which are all his action movies.
The Mummy.
Yeah, Oblivion, Night and Day,
Did any of you see The Mummy?
No.
No.
Okay, I saw it on the plane.
Yeah,
bad. It was terrible. Yeah. It was absolutely awful. I'm just saying he's not a bona fide sure hit.
Yeah. But that's what I'm saying. When he does this action hero, he's great. So let's wind up show number 400. Yes, D.
Yeah, I mean, I think the movie should be watched if only to see... It's almost he seems inhuman, Tom Cruise does, because he's running on the streets, he seems to be on a bike dodging traffic, he's leaping out of things, you know, there's this one... I thought when I saw the movie for the first time that it was a GoPro, but it's not. There's this one shot where he leaps out of this plane. I don't know how they did it. It's a single shot which goes quite a ways, at least for a couple of minutes, as he's flying down from this.
They did it by doing it.
So I get anxious, you know, with the smallest things, and to think that somebody 10 years older than me is doing this with you know, I'm
they
sure
did
he's
like
anxious 100
jumps to get those shots.
Gosh, so it's just incredible. And I think that nervous energy, you can see it on the screen of somebody doing this for real.
Yeah.
And I think that's why the movie is more effective than most other action films. So I think as an action film, it's a 9 out of 10. But I, you know, could it be a little bit better, a little tighter with the script, all of that stuff? So I have to cut off like half a point. So it's an 8.5 for me. And right now I'm going to back down to an 8. It's probably the most most watchable, most recommendable movie of the year so far. I can just tell anybody, and a lot of people like we know who are like, oh, well, give me the name of a good action film. I'm not interested in all the little movies. This is a good action film that I could recommend to anyone. And again, I do want to give kudos to Rebecca Ferguson, who is so good here. She was, you know, so good in the previous movie as well. And there's this, he almost does a little Lost in America, Lost in Translation thing, where at the end the two female characters who kind of love him, they kind of happen to meet and they say something to each other, but you're off from the camera. Yeah. You don't see what they're telling each other, which is very similar to that famous Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson last part. Mm-hmm. So there's little things here and there. It's quite something. 8 out of 10, which seems stingy.
Joe,
my favorite entry in this franchise by a long shot. I mean, for somebody who's generally been ambivalent about these movies, I think I now get what was so fun about them.
You brainwashed Joe.
It just won me over with its sheer relentlessness. It felt, you know...
Plus you like Henry Cavill, who's Superman. So I'm sure the Superman music was playing in your
Henry
head.
Henry Cavill is good, but he needs to be shaved.
I was going to say, he was very different.
He needs to lose weight.
He's very different.
He needs
different.
To lose bulky. Weight. What's that? He's so disgusting. He's so bulky. He looks
he's
like
been hitting
a piece
the protein shakes. Yeah.
But
yeah.
He looks like a cow.
I know.
He looks like just a block.
Sorry, back to Joe's summing
meat.
Up.
He looks like a block of meat, but anyway, yes.
I'm going to give this a 9 out of 10.
Wow.
And I don't know why it's not a 10. I mean, it's a perfect movie as far as I'm concerned. I literally don't see anything that they could have done better in this particular entry. It's a slick, you know, Fury Road is such a great yardstick for it, because that's exactly how it felt from beginning to end.
It's impossible not to enjoy yourself at this movie if you choose to accept Solid 8 out of 10. Solid.
Yeah, and we don't need
I feel like it needs its own category. It's not like an 8 out of 10, like, movie I gave out an 8 out of 10. It's not like your average 8 out of 10. It's just a...
8th grade.
It's really a, you robust, know, it's like a
strong,
really good 8 out of 10.
And, you know, we didn't even talk about what I think is the best scene in the film. It's in the trailer. It's this brawl, just bare knuckles brawl, which bathroom. Happens in the bathroom of this Paris. I was going
to mention it because the sink like touches Henry Cavill's muscle and just like explodes.
But that, did you notice? I mean, that I didn't even realize that until I saw it the second time. It's not very long, but it kind of makes, it leaves a really strong impression.
Yeah.
And there is no background score.
Yes, it's
people
yeah.
beating, people feel, being hurled against the wall. Yeah. And it's so beautifully choreographed. Go on.
I was going to say, I mean, that was very reminiscent to me of the opening brawl in Casino Royale, the Bond
yes.
movie.
Yes,
with, yes.
Okay, I see
and,
that, yeah.
And what was particularly reminiscent of me was how much people get hurt. Mm-hmm. Because I think that was striking.
It was bone crunching.
What was really striking in Casino Royale was that, you know, we often see these action movie heroes end up in these fights and then they kind of dust off their shoulder,
yeah.
you know, and go on about their business back to the cocktail party. Whereas, you know, Casino Royale, the Craig implementation of Bond in that movie, you know, had bruised. I mean, you could see he was in pain. You know, he had to go patch himself up and have painkillers and. You know, recombobulate. So that felt very much similar here, especially yeah. when we see one of the characters actually, you know, taken out of the scene.
Yeah. What made me laugh though is that, you know, if you were a party goer at that party, they were at the club.
Yeah.
You'd be thinking like, who are these men? They're yeah. Why so are they, out of place? Right,
why
here,
are they wearing
right?
suits?
Yeah.
To a rave?
Exactly. Yeah.
It's a rave party.
I was like,
right?
this
it's
is a, so
why
weird.
Why are they wearing suits?
Yeah.
It's Paris. Of course, they're wearing yeah. suits. All right, well, let's wrap up the podcast.
Episode 400.
Yay! Here's to 400.
How long?
More.
That's probably the longest year.
An hour and 10, we did indulge ourselves. Bad. But, you know, we've got to do that once in a while. So hopefully I will get this uploaded to YouTube at some point. And let us know what you think of the movie format, the video. I know
the cat made an appearance.
Shied away from doing video in part because it's a lot more work. But
and we have to brush our hair.
And yeah, I had to change my shirt. Yeah, yeah. Rashmi was complaining about the holes in the shirt that I was wearing before I came on this. So
this is
a fresh shirt, I will have you know.
Wow. Yes, it was.
Okay, until our next episode, too many movies, too little time. Yeah. Goodbye from me.
And me.
And me as well. Now we shall drink.
Yes.
Yes, well, actually, what is that, Yasdi?
Moscato.
It's so cute.
It's a very, very...
Yeah, and Joe, you missed that Yazdi brought all these things out of his little tiny messenger bag. He was like Mary Poppins. It didn't stop. And then I was thinking, oh my God, our snacks are so not good that Yazdi has to bring...
It's called
Funf.
It's not just fun, it's Funf. That's German for the number 5. Funf Moscato. Thank you very much, Yazdi.
Sure. Right. No, I felt we should celebrate.